Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2023 Home Education Conference held in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
At the beginning of the class, I just want to say I am not a math major. I am not a math teacher or anything like that, but my degree is in chemical engineering, so I did do a lot of math, so hopefully that kind of qualifies me for being able to teach this class. But really, I'm just a homeschooling mom like you all, trying to figure out how to teach my kids math and how to teach them to love it, because that's very difficult with math. I've always loved math quite a bit. It makes a lot of sense to me. I enjoy the process of learning it. I'm not like a math whiz, but I caught on pretty quickly. And to me, the way I see math, it's just like puzzles and patterns. Like, numbers are fascinating to me. Even now at this age, the things that I learn, I'm like, it's all just like patterns. Even when you get into the really big numbers or the complicated calculations, it's still just patterns and puzzles. And I really love puzzles, so it's like my thing. I was never the kid that said, I hate math, why do I have to do math? So growing up, when I would hear kids say that, I'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, I couldn't relate. I don't understand that. But, of course, I have kids that say that sometimes now. And so I've done a lot of thinking about that. Like, why math? Because you don't hear that about, like, I hate art. Why do we have to do art? Like, you don't hear that about reading or history, really, even. Maybe sometimes, but math is a very common, I hate math, I don't want to do it, like, they don't like it. So why math? What is it? Why this question that they always ask? So I have a little story, and it's, sorry, late afternoon, like, really sleepy time, but I'm going to read you a story. So if you close your eyes, don't feel bad. I won't take offense. The story is A Mathematician's Lament by Paul Lockhart, and it was, but when I read it a couple years ago, it really changed the way that I think about and view math and how to teach it. And so that's why I want to share it with you today, because it's pretty short. A musician wakes up from a terrible nightmare. In his dream, he finds himself in a society where music education has been made mandatory. We are helping our students become more competitive in an increasingly sound-filled world. Educators, school systems, and the state are put in charge of this vital project. Studies are commissioned, committees are formed, and decisions are made, all without the advice or participation of a single working musician or composer. Since musicians are known to set down their ideas in the form of sheet music, these curious black dots and lines must constitute the language of music. It is imperative that students become fluent in this language if they are to attain any degree of musical competence. Indeed, it would be ludicrous to expect a child to sing a song or play an instrument without having a thorough grounding in music theory and notation. Playing and listening to music, let alone composing an original piece, are considered very advanced topics and are generally put off until college and more often graduate school. As the primary and secondary schools, their mission is to train students to use this language, to jiggle symbols around according to a fixed set of rules. Music class is where we take out our staff paper, our teacher puts some notes on the board, and we copy them or transpose them into a different key. We have to make sure to get the clefs and the key signatures right, and our teacher is very picky about making sure we fill in all of our quarter notes completely. One time, we had a chromatic scale problem, and I did it right, but the teacher gave me no credit because I had the stems pointing the wrong way. In their wisdom, educators soon realized that even very young children can be given this kind of musical instruction. In fact, it is considered quite shameful if one's third grader hasn't completely memorized his circle of fifths. I'll have to get my son a music tutor. He simply won't apply himself to his music homework. He says it's boring. He just sits there staring out the window, humming tunes to himself, and making up silly songs. In the higher grades, the pressure is really on. After all, the students must be prepared for the standardized tests and college admission exams. Students must take courses in scales and modes, meter, harmony, and counterpoint. It's a lot for them to learn, but later in college, when they finally get to hear all this stuff, they'll really appreciate all the work they did in high school. Of course, not many students actually go on to concentrate on music, so only a few will ever get to hear the sounds that the black dots represent. Nevertheless, it is important that every member of society be able to recognize a modulation or a fugal passage, regardless of the fact that they will never hear one. To tell you the truth, most students just aren't very good at music. They are bored in class, their skills are terrible, and their homework is barely legible. Most of them couldn't care less about how important music is in today's world. They just want to take the minimum number of music courses and be done with it. I guess there are just music people and non-music people. I had this one kid though, man, she was sensational. Her sheets, they were impeccable. Every note in the right place, perfect calligraphy, sharps, flats, just beautiful. She's gonna make one heck of a musician someday. Waking up in a cold sweat, the musician realizes gratefully that it was all just a crazy dream. Of course, he reassures himself, no society would ever reduce such a beautiful and meaningful art form to something so meaningless and trivial. No culture would be so cruel to its children as to deprive them of such a natural, satisfying means of human expression. How absurd. Meanwhile, on the other side of town, a painter has just awakened from a similar nightmare. I was surprised to find myself in a regular school classroom. No easels, no tubes of paint. And I lost my place. Oh, we don't actually paint until high school, I was told by the students. In seventh grade, we mostly do study of colors and applicators. They showed me a worksheet. On one side were swatches of color with blank spaces next to them. They were told to write in the names. I like painting, one of them remarked. They tell me what to do, and I do it. It's easy. After class, I spoke with the teacher. So your students don't actually do any painting, I asked. Well, next year, they will take pre-paint by numbers. That prepares them for the main paint by numbers sequence in high school. So they'll get used to what they've learned here and apply it to real life painting situations. You know, dipping the brush in paint, wiping it off, stuff like that. Of course, we track our students by ability. They are really excellent painters. The ones who know their colors and brushes forward and backwards, they get to actually paint a little sooner, and some of them even take the advanced placement classes for college credit. But mostly, we're just trying to give these kids a good foundation in what painting is all about. So when they get out there in the real world and they paint their kitchens, they won't make a total mess of it. These high school classes you mentioned. Oh, you mean the paint by numbers? We're seeing much higher enrollments lately. I think it's mostly coming from the parents wanting to make sure their kids get into a good college. Nothing looks better than advanced paint by numbers on a high school transcript. What do colleges care if they can fill in numbered regions with the corresponding color? Oh, well, you know, it shows clear-headed logical thinking. And of course, if a student is planning to major in one of the visual sciences, like fashion or interior decorating, then it's a really good idea to get your painting requirements out of the way in high school. I see. And when do students get to paint freely on blank canvas? Oh, you sound like one of my professors. They were always going on about expressing yourself and your feelings and things like that. Really way out of their abstract stuff. I've got a degree in painting myself, but I've never really worked much with blank canvases. I just use the paint by number kits supplied by the school board. That's the story. Super funny, super entertaining and humorous and absurd, but sadly, it describes almost perfectly how our culture and society approach and view mathematics, if you think about it. It's a required subject that we learn pretty advanced mechanics that we never really use. I mean, a lot of it we don't use anyway, depending on, you know, what your degree is, what you're going to go into. And it's easy to see from this story where the question of why do I need to learn math? I don't like math. You can kind of see where this question is developing from. And also from these examples, it's easy to see that if you just learn the mechanics of something, it's like taking the soul out of it. There's no more fun, there's no more excitement, there's no playfulness or exploration. And I believe that we all have built within us mathematical, intuitive understanding. I think we all have it. You know, it's a lot of kids will say, well, I'm just not good at math. I don't believe that. I think it's innately in us, all of us. It's just a matter of finding out how we learn math or how we see it versus somebody else. But I think we all have it within us. You know, sure, there are some that are better at it than others, but just like the painting and the music example, little kids make up songs. My kids will go up to the piano and play songs that they've heard, and some of them have never had lessons. So just because they haven't learned like the music theory and how to do the scales and all that, it doesn't mean they can't learn music or learn about it or appreciate it and understand it on some level. Okay, so I think playing with math is a lot like playing with music and art. I don't think it's really any different. In my life, I've had about three experiences that I didn't enjoy learning math. And so as I teach my kids math, I have looked back on my life, like, when did I find it hard? When did I not like it? And what was the cause of it? Because naturally, I like it and I'm pretty good at it. So I'm just going to share those three experiences with you and the principle that I've learned from each story or experience. So the first one was when I was in fifth grade, and my school was kind of a newer school, and they were trying out a new advanced math program, and I was asked to participate. So at a designated time every other day, a group of us went into another classroom for this advanced class, and there were kids from several grades that were feeding into this classroom, enough to kind of fill it up. And I remember sitting at tables with other students, and that's it. Like, I don't remember anything else. I think it's partly because I've like blocked that memory in my head. So why share this experience if I really have no details about it? Other than I remember going to this class and just having this feeling of dread and like worry and like, I don't want to do this. So the lesson that I gained from this experience is that I, a math-loving kid, when I was pushed beyond my capability of doing something, math became a foreign language to me, and I no longer understood it. Like, I was asked to do things that I wasn't ready for. And so I crumbled. Okay, so my second negative memory that I have is my AP Calculus class that I took as a junior in high school. And there were two AP Calculus classes offered. One was AB, one was BC, and BC is the harder one. And I have like this Einstein older brother, and he's like, oh, take the BC, it'll be great. But a little bit of background here. So I started out in public school, and about halfway through eighth grade, my brother was pulled out because he was being bullied. And I was kind of watching that, and I was like, I want to do that too. So my mom's like, okay, she pulled me out, and I started homeschooling. And I did the Saxon Math program, and they don't have, like, it's a different program than the public schools use. And so my math knowledge had holes in it compared to the one that the public school is using. And so, like, they don't have, or I just learned that they do now have a geometry book. But at the time that I was doing it, they did not have geometry as a separate class. It was just kind of sprinkled in through the other ones. And then they also didn't have a trigonometry class either. And so I get into this calculus class, and the first couple weeks, they're just reviewing, you know, so everyone just knows what's going on and whatever. And I was like, what? Like, I don't know how to do any of this. All the trigonometry, I was like, this is so new to me. Like, what are they even talking about? It was a very horrible first couple of weeks. It was a very horrible experience. And I would come home with a headache every day. It was like the last 2 hours of the day. And it was exhausting and horrible. And of course, my older brother was like my cheerleader. He's like, just stay in it, it'll get better. So I trusted him, and he was right. It did get better. And I passed my test at the end of the year, so it was fine. But the lesson that I gained from this experience is that if you move too quickly before confidence and understanding can take place, it will be a negative experience. And it manifests in different ways depending on the child. But for me, it was headaches and like, oh, dread. Didn't have confidence in myself. I didn't like math again for a little bit of time. But yeah, don't move too quickly. Okay, so the third one is an experience I had at BYU. I had to take a class called Ordinary Differential Equations. Well, what are ordinary differential equations, you may ask? I don't really know anymore. I barely learned enough to pass the class, and I quickly forgot everything after the class. And my husband took the class like about a year later because he is also an engineer, and I was supposed to like help tutor him. I mean, I did a little bit, like I pulled out my notes and looked at him, could kind of help him a little bit, but I had forgotten everything. And so the question is like, why did I struggle with this class? Why did I forget everything so quickly? And I think actually the answer to both of those questions is that I saw absolutely no reason why I would ever use ordinary differential equations. And you know what? Since that class, I never have. And I have never discovered where anyone would use ordinary differential equations. So completely no relevance whatsoever to life. Like I had nothing to tie that knowledge to. Like why would I use it? What is the reason for it? Okay, so I don't need to recap because you can see them on the screen here. But we're going to visit each one of these individually and talk a little bit about them. So don't push beyond one's capacity. This is a pretty easy principle. It kind of makes sense, especially when we apply it to similar things in life, like learning to walk. When a baby starts to roll from one side to the other, we don't pick them up and put them in the center of the room and say, okay, walk. Okay, they're just not quite ready for that. We let them master the rolling, then the scooting, then the crawling, and then the walking. And also like learning to ride a bike with the training wheels. You know, sometimes there's training wheels, sometimes there's not. But we give the child a chance to learn that balance that they need to work the bike. And, you know, sometimes it takes a parent holding the back of the bike like the first 20 or 100 or 1,000 times to get them to like get that balance right. It takes time. But when our children are just learning to read, another great example is, you know, we use those like beginner readers. We don't take like Shakespeare's entire collection and plop it in front of them and be like, after this book you'll have it down. You know, we wait till like high school or way older or whatever, when they're ready to give them that Shakespeare. So math is the exact same way, and I like math because it is very logical and it does build upon each other. And so obviously you learn to add before you learn to multiply, because multiplying is based on addition. So there are some very natural steps to follow with math, which actually makes it easier to teach. So that's good for us as the teachers. Okay, so the second one, don't move too quickly before confidence and understanding can take place. So learning is a process. So don't push them faster than they are able or willing to learn. I was one who loved math and I did it well, but when I was pushed too quickly, before I had gained a confidence and understanding, then my mathematical footing, so to speak, was interrupted and I crumbled and kind of fell apart. So again, not good to push too quickly. So you have to be in tune to how they're doing. On the flip side, I'll add too though, it's really destructive for them to be bored with math as well. Like if they have it down, let them move on. I think being pushed too fast or too slow have very similar effects. So if we want our children to be educated, the process is more important than the content that they learn. Why? Because the process is what creates lifelong habits that bring benefits for a lifetime. The content can be learned at any time, and they have the same lifetime to learn that content. And the more they enjoy the process of learning, the more content they will actually end up learning. So we want them to actually love learning. And if it is at the expense of them not being caught up with their peers in math, it is okay. It's more important for them to love what they're doing and to love that process of learning. And the whole secret to a love of learning is that if they love it, it makes your job so much easier. And sometimes you don't even have to be present for them to take it away and learn on their own if they're excited enough about it. So we're going to take a little bit of a detour under this one here, The Seven Keys of Great Teaching by Oliver DeMille. I use these a lot in my homeschooling and especially my math. So we're going to go through these just really briefly. The first one is classics, not textbooks. So when you think of a classic, it's not like the dusty books on your grandpa's shelf. It's any book or work of art or music or whatever that you can return to time and time again and gain something new out of every time. So a classic example of a classic is like the scriptures. We read those over and over and over, and we keep reading them over and over. We don't say, well, yeah, I've read the Book of Mormon. I'm good, got that. But we gain something new every time. That's a classic. Textbooks, like curriculums and stuff like that, there's nothing wrong with them, but I would encourage you to use them as a guide for yourself in teaching your kids and knowing like what will come next and next and next, rather than giving them the curriculum or the textbook and saying, okay, now you go through all the problems and go through the problem sets or whatever, but use it more as a guide for yourself to give them their work. Okay, so the second one, mentors, not professors. So just picture in your mind a professor from like one of your college classes, and then picture in your mind like a mentor that you've had for yourself or one of your kids. There's a huge difference in just the feeling of that person. A lot of my professors, I kind of slept through their classes. They're boring. Anyway, I could go on, but you know what I'm talking about. But mentors tend to have an excitement for the topic that they are teaching. And that excitement is contagious, and the kids will catch it. So even if it's not something they're super interested in, just having that person that's like super excited about it can really make a difference for their learning. So especially like with math or whatever, if you feel like your child isn't excited about it, invite someone in who is super passionate about math and have them, you know, be a guest speaker for the day or whatever, and it'll make a difference because it's contagious. So okay, the next one is inspire, not require. This is a difficult one. But simply put, let your kids see you doing what you want them to do. That is where inspiration comes. So applying this to math, if your kids don't want to do math, they're not excited about it, one of the first things that you could do is sit down and do some math for you, or read a math classic or something like that. Set the example of learning that specific thing, learning math. Let them see you doing it and getting excited about it. One thing that I've discovered in teaching math to my younger kids, like I said, like I was pretty good at math. I understand it fairly well, like growing up and everything, but going back now teaching it to my young ones, I understand it way better. Like I understand, it's almost like seeing a play and being able to understand the story and what's going on versus being able to see what's going on backstage as well. Like there's just a deeper understanding, like, oh, that's how that pattern works, or that's how you figure such and such out. Like I've learned actually more about math now teaching it to my kids. Simple things, even like multiplying and things like that. Anyway, so there's still more to learn about math. You're not done. You can inspire them by continuing your math education. Okay, structure time, not content. Another super important thing for math, because it does require a lot of brain power to do math. I always put my math first in the day of my school day. Math always comes first when they're fresh and rested. And so if you just set a block of time that you're going to be working on math, then it kind of takes away the, like, we have to get through this lesson. It's a different perspective, a different framework where, okay, we have an hour. Let's just see what we can do with this. If you get one problem done, great. If you get 10, great. You know, whatever happens is fine, but you are doing math for an hour. I never do anything for an hour, but whatever, like a half hour. But you'll have more consistent and more efficient progress doing it that way. All right. Number five, quality, not conformity. Okay, so this is actually a really important one for math. Don't have them do a problem and be like, oh yeah, that's good enough. Like, it's okay. I would spend some time having them check their work, look over it, make sure, like, they've got it pretty, I mean, they've got it right. They've got it accurate. And I have a couple of examples to kind of express and show you why I say this, especially for math. So the first one is, these are real life experiences of kind of like people that weren't super thorough in their math. Airliners crash due to square windows. Okay, so when they first started having jetliners that like people could go on and whatever, it was the 1950s, there was a company leading the pack, and it was called De Havilland Comet, and it was like a state-of-the-art jet with never before seen features like pressurized cabins, and they flew faster and farther than other aircrafts. Unfortunately, in 1954, two comets disintegrated mid-flight for no apparent reason, killing 56 people. And the flaw was laughable, actually. It's because it had square windows. Like, that was the reason. In engineering, the sharp corner of, so like this, for example, the sharp corner of a square is a stress concentration point. So you can see on the square corner, it's like turns that deep red. There's a lot of stress concentrated right there. Whereas the more rounded you get, the more it distributes the stress. And so, as you can imagine, a plane up in the sky, there's a lot of stress and pressure on that airplane. And if you can distribute it more evenly, then you're not gonna have as many failures. So just like you see like windows that are on like a brick house, you'll see the cracks. They kind of feed out from the corners of the windows. It's the same sort of concept. And so I have a picture of an actual plane here, and you can see every single corner is rounded, and all the corners on airplanes are rounded for that reason. Okay, so then I have another example. The Tacoma Bridge collapse. Little video.
Tacoma Bridge, Washington, opened only a few months ago, was built at a cost of over $6 million. But misfortune overtakes the bridge structure. These are some of the most amazing pictures ever recorded by a newsreel. The actual collapse of the world's third largest suspension bridge. But this apparently sets up a rhythmic swinging of the bridge, which increases with each swing. Finally, the swinging rod and the suspension cables give way and plunge into the water below. Fortunately, the only casualties were a car stalled on the bridge and a dog.
Okay, so great example of you got to get your stuff done correctly, right? So you could show this little clip to your kids and be like, this is why we have to get it right, because it just takes a small little silly mistake to have, you know, disastrous consequences. And there are tons all over the internet if you want to look for more. But I had a good time actually looking at them. It was fun. But it's important, especially with math, to get it right. Have them spend the time to understand how to get it right, how to check their answers. You know, there is a lot of pressure to stay up with their peers and stay caught up with math, especially. I don't know why math, like, nothing else seems to matter quite as much, but math. Anyway.
It's quantifiable.
Probably, like, you can measure it.
Like, you can measure that.
Yes.
Like, reading skills, sometimes it's a little bit more nebulous.
I think you are right.
And math is very quantifiable. And so we want quantifiable proof that we're okay.
Right? But then, also along with that is, do you really need the math that we go to? Like,
no.
Do you?
Yeah, exactly.
Have you guys ever used, like, the highest math you took? Neither have I. Okay, and I'm an engineer. There's lots of ways to exercise your brain. It's not just math. Anyway, okay, so the last one. Wait, no, we're on number 6. Okay, simplicity, not complexity. All right, so this is a good one. Especially with math, because it's complex all on its own. You don't need to make it more so. Just keep it simple, is the lesson, pretty much. If you have to play to show them how to do it or whatever, that's fine. Also, like, you get out there and there are all kinds of curriculums and manipulatives and all these tools out there. Okay, if it's overwhelming, just pull out a piece of paper and a pencil. And that's what I do. Well, we use whiteboards. But anyway, just keep it simple, right?
We never use rays. The old, the 1800s rays arithmetic. It's the equivalent of the McGuffey's readers, but it's the math.
Oh.
And I love them because in one lesson, we introduce fractions and they go from saying, it teaches using your own mind to figure it out instead of here's the steps to figure out a problem. So it'll go from being like, what's half an apple? And by the end of just a verbal few minute lessons, you're doing pretty complex fractions. But nobody told you how to do the fractions. You figured it out using logic.
Okay, I love that. I love that. So that's actually how I teach math. I didn't even realize it. But that's what I do. And I love it because I teach math in groups to my kids. And so I will give a problem such as that. And they all, you know, will come up with an answer. They show me their answer. Most of the time, they're all correct. And then I have them tell me how they did it. And that is the fun part because they all did it differently. Mm-hmm. But they came up with the right answer. Like, we are taught that there's like one way to get the right answer. So not true. That is not true. There's a lot of ways. And depending on how they think, they're going to do it differently. That's actually been one of my challenges in teaching math is I think about it one way. And all of my kids do it a different way, except for one child. So when I got to him and I could hear him, he would verbally say what he was thinking. I'm like, oh my gosh, I love you. You're doing it exactly how I do it. I understand you. Mm-hmm. Finally, it was number six. You know, it took me a while.
So you see them using a math curriculum that's trying to teach a concept and telling them to do it this way. Because they're like, I want to do it this way. That's fine with me, as long as you get this.
What I do.
So many ways.
Yes.
For the answer.
Yes,
if
amen.
The right answer, I don't care how you do it.
I love that. See, we think alike. okay, so number seven, the last one is you, not them. This one is easiest to explain with an example of a classroom. So if you're a student in a class and you're not getting anything out of the class, whose fault is it? It's yours, right? If you are the teacher in the class and it's not going so well and, you know, the class is not ending up how you wanted it to, whose fault is it? It's yours. So you need to own what you have responsibility over. Like, you sit in a boring class and it can be fantastic if you are seeking, if you are searching. So don't steal that away from your kids, I guess is what I'm saying. Let them figure it out. Let them do the work. You, not them. Okay? Okay. Well, I'm turning back. So hopefully these seven keys will help you. Like, you can apply them anywhere in your homeschools or life, because these are principles that apply everywhere. Okay, so my advice to anyone who has a child who struggles with or doesn't like math is to remember to slow down and don't move so quickly so that they can have confidence and understanding. The same thing with, like, learning to read, right? It's the same sort of concept. Like, if they're struggling, you take them down, like, a couple levels so that they can get that confidence in themselves. Because it's really their motivation that's going to take them forward. And so you want them to have that. You don't want them to lose that. And there's no rush. There's no rush. They have all of lifetime to learn math. And if there's something they need to know, they'll learn it when they need it. So, okay, so I heard a saying one time. And I, for many years, just like clung to this saying. And it's homeschoolers are late bloomers. And when the lady said that, I was like, oh, okay, good. Like, it just gave me peace in my heart because I felt like all of my kids were behind, you know, behind, whatever that means. And I had so many of them, and they were all so little, and I just felt a lot of pressure to, anyway, have them be on track or ahead. And that's not what was happening, so I was really nervous. But as my older ones have, well, as they've grown up and my older ones have grown up, wow, they're incredible people. And it all works out. So just keep doing what you're doing and realize that homeschoolers are late bloomers. It will come because we, especially as homeschoolers, I think we work really hard on the foundation. Have that foundation, then great things are possible. And they can hold a lot more on that sure foundation. So the foundation is important to build right. All right. So the third one, make math relevant and show how and where to apply the concepts being learned. Textbooks are not always the best at showing how different math concepts are relevant to life or each other. There are some curriculums that are better at this than others, but I would say overall most math curriculums are not good at this, not good at the application part. So I would encourage you to figure out situations in life where you're going to learn the concepts that you, or where you're going to show the concepts that you're learning, like how to apply them, where am I going to use this, why is this relevant to me, and create those situations so you can demonstrate it. So for example, why in the world do I need to learn how to round? Well, I'll take them shopping, give them a certain amount of money and tell them that they can buy whatever they want with the money, as long as they don't go over the amount that you gave them. Otherwise, they get nothing. And by the way, there's a time limit. Okay, so this shows them, okay, if I can round the numbers, I can be a lot more quick with my adding and a lot more accurate. Another example is, why would I ever need fractions? Why do I need to know fractions? Well, I'll get a cookie recipe, tell them that they can make as many cookies as they want, as long as they don't make just a single batch, like they have to double it or triple it, or, you know. And then they will understand why they need to know fractions, because they may not want to eat the cookies they make if they don't do their fractions right. So the third example, skip counting, seriously, like who needs to count any differently than 1, 2, 3, 4? So get a big bag of Skittles, have your kids count them. Whoever can count them the fastest gets to keep the whole bag. So skip counting is going to get that job done a lot faster. So find ways to show them where they're going to use the math that they're learning and help them see how to apply the concepts. And if you don't know, if you can't think of a way to apply it, you can resort to my husband's oft-repeated advice. Google it, okay? Or ask people. Like, it's out there. You can find ways to demonstrate all kinds of things. Okay, so the last little bit here, we're going to do, let's see, I'm going to go through a couple of tips and tricks that I've used through the years, it's using some of these principles and some other things. So the first one is introduce the language and concepts of math in everyday life. So here's where it really is applying to younger kids, like before they even start formal math. Use the terms in the language of mathematics, like bigger than, smaller than, fraction. Like, do they even know what a fraction is at a young age? You can explain that, and they can understand partially what that means. Part, percent, ratios, probability, shape names and numbers, things like that. And you can start this very early on. Again, even before you have them actually doing math. If you're using the language in your home, then it won't, that part at least won't be foreign to them. They'll recognize it, they'll feel a little bit more comfortable and familiar with it. And I think I probably do this okay just because, like, I'm an engineer, so I use the terms in a lot of what I do. And so this is something I've seen, it's really helped my kids. You can also, okay, we're not there yet. Point out situations when and where you use math. So when you go to the grocery store, we're always doing math in our head. If you were to stop and just kind of watch yourself and notice, we literally are almost always doing math. So if you can convert that verbally to your children, then they will see the relevance of math. They'll see, okay, yeah, I actually am going to use this stuff because you use it all the time. And if you start noticing and looking and seeing it, math is everywhere. So I thought this would be very helpful. Let's see. Okay. Speed round. So I have two scenarios that kind of show you, this is how I think, but I think that all homeschoolers kind of develop this sort of way of thinking as they go into it. But I'm going to go through a scenario of like going to the grocery store and kind of showing you like what are the possibilities of doing math. Like this can be your math lesson. You don't have to pull out a book. So you get in the car, you point out on your odometer how fast you're going. This is called speed. And it's a rate. What is the speed posted on the speed limit sign? How much faster or slower are we going than what is posted? So our speed is greater than or less than the speed limit. Oh, looks like we need gas. Is the tank empty? No. What fraction of the tank is full or empty? What percent is that? How much does each kind of gas cost per gallon? Which one's going to cost me more? which one's going to cost the least? Okay, a more advanced question might be to have them like guesstimate how much they're going to spend to fill the tank. And then you can check when you're done how close they are. So back on the road, maybe these are your littles. They can count the red cars going by. Now they can count the blue ones. What color does there seem to be more of? What color do you think there will be the least of? At the grocery store, if there's 20 aisles and we spend 5 minutes in each aisle, how long is our trip going to take? Compare prices of two different brands of the same type of item, which will be a better bargain. Point out how to read the price tags and why each piece of information is relevant, like where you would use each of the pieces of information. If the shopping trip isn't too long, or if you have just a few things that you have to get, you can have them keep a running total that they can then use at the checkout to kind of figure out with the tax how it's going to cost. Again, that's more of an older kid one. But okay, if there's 12 people in your family and there's a box of crackers that has 10 packages in it and a box that has 15 in it, which one or ones should we buy so everyone in the family gets one of each and we end up spending the least? Or which one or ones do we buy so everyone gets one and we have the fewest left over? Because that may not be the same. When buying produce, use the scales to weigh and calculate costs. You can also use the scales to compare weights. You can also use the scales for them to get a feel for how heavy certain things are. So you can have them pick something up. How heavy do you think that is? Okay, weigh it and check it. Okay, so when you go to pay, again, you can have them calculate the approximate cost using your tax rate for your state, and then they can see like how far off was I. For the really young children, you can point out different colors and shapes, how many rows are there of this cereal or that, etc. You could have them look at the price tags and see if they can find a 2 or a 6. You can show an example of a decimal number and that they use to indicate the price of an item, and what is that dot called again? You know, you just ask them questions about like what's around you. So you can see, like, literally there's math everywhere and we're always doing it. So if we can verbalize it for our children, they can also come to see it and see the relevance of it. The other scenario I have is baking cookies. And here's a tip, don't ever let them make the recipe, like have them always at least double it. We've had a couple of failures in our fractions, but that's okay. They learn, right? So again, this is a great opportunity to add fractions, but also to use conversions, like how many teaspoons are in a tablespoon, how many cups are in a pint, things like that. You can get the kitchen scale and use that for measurements every once in a while. And that's a great opportunity to compare weights and use conversion factors and talk about volume versus weight, like which one is more accurate when measuring powders like flour and sugar versus ingredients like peanut butter or milk, you know, volume or weight. How many cookies fit on a tray? Is that an even number or an odd number? How do you know? Why would this be important to know if I were making homemade Oreos? If we bake 3 trays, how many cookies will we have? What about 7 trays? You could also talk about the difference of the Fahrenheit and Celsius scales. So for the older children, you can give them the conversion problem and you can have them convert their 350 degrees to what Celsius is this. If the kids are eating cookies as you bake them, you can kind of keep track of how many each kid is eating, and then afterward ask, like, what was the average amount of cookies that everybody ate? Some easier questions might be, what shape are the cookies? What shape are the chocolate chips? What about the cube of butter? You could talk about the two-dimensional cookie sheet and parchment paper versus, like, the three-dimensional cookies and the ingredients you're using. You can count the cookies on the tray, how many are in each row, how many in each column, what's the difference between a row and a column. Once the cookies are done, count all the cookies. If each tray took 9 minutes to bake, how many minutes total did it take us to bake all those cookies? And how many hours is that? Pretend I'm gonna eat half the cookies. How many would that be? What if I only eat half a tray? If I divide the cookies equally among the family, exactly evenly, how many would everyone get? Would there be any left over? Would you have to cut any in pieces? How many of the cookies into how many pieces? What if I took a third? I gave a third to the family and a third to you, whoever made them. How many would we each get? If you used a scale to weigh the ingredients, you could create like a bar graph or a chart comparing the weights of the ingredients. So those are just a few examples. There's tons more. So if you have the eye of math as you're going through life and you verbalize it, your kids will be able to see that. Okay, so the second tip and trick that I have is read math classics. We kind of went over this. It's a way to inspire your kids. And you'll come, and when you come across stuff that's like really cool, share it. And then they can see your excitement for it. Okay, and I have a slide at the end of my presentation that has like some math classics for ideas if you want. Okay, number three, make math fun. Math, like art, I think, is very, it lends itself to a lot of interactive and active sort of learning. I don't know why we don't do math that way more often, but it's a good subject to teach that way. So you can use Play-Doh or 3D shapes, any of the manipulatives. Another tip or trick, there are so many manipulatives, like I said. So go online, look at what they are, and then go in your home and find things that will work the same, right? You don't have to spend any money. Use what you have. Okay. So, really quickly, ideas of different ways to teach. So Saxon, like I said, very traditional, or any other curriculum, fill in the blank, you can use that. Again, I would encourage using it more of a guide for yourself than having your kids actually go through it and do it themselves. And you can use that curriculum any way you want. Just because you have a math curriculum doesn't mean you have to do every problem. Do every other problem, or do five problems out of the whole problem set, or what, like, you can adapt it to your children. Time tests, my kids love these because they're very competitive, and they all do the time tests together. So from, you know, they're doing the same time test, and it's super fun. And I even do it with them, and no one can beat me yet, but maybe someday. So it's really fun for them to work up to, okay, I'm gonna beat mom. Worksheets, these aren't the best, but little kids like worksheets. If you have like two or three problems, just two or three, and maybe a picture to color. You know, they like to color and whatever, create on their paper. But keep it short, like not a lot of problems. We talked about manipulatives. Life of Fred is another really, really good way to just help them with their mathematical thinking. It's hilarious. I don't know if you guys have ever read Life of Fred. I love them because I laugh hysterically the whole time. And my kids are like, wow, what's so funny? Then I have to explain because it's kind of adult humor. Not like inappropriate, but just like you need a little bit more knowledge and background to understand. And it's so fun. The last one, this is the one I like the most. So learning in groups. My most successful math I've ever done is put my kids, I had four of them at the time, at a round table, all have whiteboards. I'm sitting at my desk and I have the Saxon math book in front of me. I'm looking through the lesson. Okay, we'll cover this vocabulary word and this, we'll try this problem. And I just give it to them, but we do it in all different kinds of ways. Like sometimes I'll give them a problem, then they work it, then they show me their board. Or I'll say, okay, whoever can do it the fastest or whoever can get it right. And then sometimes I'll say, okay, you make up this kind of a problem for the others. Okay, now you make up the problem for the others. There's so many ways to do it, and they can interact with each other, and it's fun because they can socialize and be with each other, and we laugh and we have fun and we're learning math all at the same time. So that's been my most successful way to teach is in groups. So in conclusion, and there's my book list. In conclusion, I want to remind you that I am not a math expert, so to speak. But these kind of things have been shared with you today that are principles and methods that I have learned through the years, and I have actually used them in my homeschooling, and they have been effective, at least for my kids. So I hope that there's something in what I've said today that can be helpful. And that is pretty much it. So, and we're out of time. So if you have questions, you can ask. Otherwise, we're good. So thank you.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.